Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, hour number two of the program. We're glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the control this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about what has been called the credit crisis, the credit crunch, the subprime mortgage crisis, and a little bit about what that means, why it happened, and looking at it from looking at some of the regulatory questions involved here in credit. Talking this morning with a professor of law here from the University of Illinois. His name is Robert Lawless. He's interested in and expert in the fields of bankruptcy and corporate law. He's also one of six regular contributors to a blog called Credit Slips, which is all about discussing credit and bankruptcy. He's also a member of the Consumer Bankruptcy Project. It's a long-term study looking at people who file bankruptcy. And he's visiting here with us this morning in the studio, and we're pleased to have him on the show. Questions are certainly welcome. I know he'll take his best shot to answer your questions. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and also toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions there, welcome. We just ask people to try to keep their questions brief. We can keep people keep moving along here and get as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call and give us a shout. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
This is I don't want to get too much into the economics of this, I guess, but because I think that in as much as this whole business has been discussed, I think there's still some people who are really not quite sure what it is we're talking about, what happened and why. So maybe just again to review the basics as I understand them. What we have here is a situation that and it's not just something that started within the past couple of years. I think that some people would say, well, the foundations for where we are were laid down, you know, maybe at least a decade ago. And that what we had was lenders who were interested in drumming up business. And what they did was they offered loans to people on what might have seemed to be pretty attractive terms with very low down payments and adjustable rates of interest, and that maybe they weren't looking as carefully as they should have at the financial background of those individuals. And so they made these loans. And so you have lots of people lending money, maybe not being as rigorous as they should in assessing people's credit worthiness. And maybe for a while that was okay. Anything else that you could add to that about just how this whole business got started?
Well, I think that's the popular conception of what happened. I think if you really want to go back, you have to lay this really begins in the late 1970s with a decision of the United States Supreme Court that may win for all-time most unintended consequence of any Supreme Court decision, where they interpreted some obscure provision of a fairly obscure federal banking law, at least obscure to the average person, that had the effect of deregulating interest rates. And that then led to really beginning the mid to late 1980s, what they called the democratization of credit, which was the spreading of credit into classes of people that previously banks wouldn't touch. And as that accelerated through the mid to late 1980s and then into the 90s, the targets of opportunity grew less and less for these financial institutions. The people that they could lend to becoming more and more marginal in terms of their credit worthiness. And consumer credit continued to expand through the 90s. The only quibble I guess I'd have with your description of what happened is I think it was apparent that at some time the party had to stop. If you think about it, there's really only three pools you can take your current income and put it into. You can put it into current consumption, rent, food, like that. You can put it into savings, or you can put it into paying off past debt. And at some point, that past debt was going to get so large that it was going to cut into the other two pots. And we saw the savings rate go down, decline to zero, and now we're having to cut back on current consumption to really to pay back past debt.
Yeah, I suppose there would be some people who would argue that one of the goals here was a good goal, and that was to increase home ownership in the United States. And I suppose some of these lenders would say all we're really doing is making it possible for people to own their homes, and is that really such a bad thing? Is it really, can one really say that the people who then maybe are suffering now because they got into these contracts that ended up initially maybe having a very attractive interest rate, and then it got to the point where the payment suddenly went up and they couldn't make them anymore. Were those really so people so unworthy of the credit that was extended to them?
Well, there's no question that what's happened in the last, let's say, 15 years has been, you know, has allowed homeownership rates to increase. The Clinton administration touted that. The Bush administration's touted that. This isn't a partisan point, right? You can lay blame in both the Clinton and Bush administrations for this. But it was housing policy on the cheap. It was increasing homeownership by allowing people to basically pledge their future income to get homes. Today, we as a nation were pledging our futures to have increased home ownership rates. And now we have to ask, you ask a very good question. What kind of home housing policy do we want in this country? Do we want a housing policy where we can get every possible person that we can into a house? If the answer to that is yes, that's a very expensive policy decision. And what happened, this tends to happen government circles, we wanted everything without having to pay for it.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose that some people would say that maybe it indeed wasn't terribly prudent for lenders or for borrowers, for that matter, to get themselves into situations where either they were borrowing, some people were borrowing a lot of money. A lot of money. And some people had mortgages that required little or no down payments. There are some people who were paying interest-only mortgages, and then there were people who were getting into adjustable-rate mortgages where, again, initially the right rate might have been very good, and those people did that. And in some cases, the lender said to them, oh, don't worry about this. You can refinance later. Then they found out that they couldn't refinance. The housing market went south, and then suddenly these people found themselves, when the rates adjusted up, with payments that they couldn't simply make. Do you put down that down to, you know, maybe imprudence of lenders taking on or a borrowers taking on debt that they really couldn't hope to satisfy? Or is that lenders who were looking to make a buck and they were extending credit under terms that were, you know, maybe otherwise they shouldn't have?
Well, let me answer that. Yes. You can say yes to all of that, right? There's lots of blame to go around here. There's no question that lenders were making loans that they should have known weren't going to get paid off. We've seen at least some hints that there have been maybe some outright, if not fraud, maybe too strong a word, but lenders knowing that they were extending loans that just weren't going to get paid off. We also know that there were a lot of borrowers out there overextending themselves. You know, on the other hand, if you look at it from the perspective of the borrower, if a borrower who couldn't get into a home, one of these risky loans was not necessarily, if just from a cold calculating cost-benefit calculation, if you couldn't get into a home, that wasn't necessarily a bad loan, a bad transaction to begin with. Why not? Why not take the risk? The worst that happens is, well, you try for a little while and you lose your home and you're back in the same place you started. One thing, though, that we do see is that people don't look at their home just as any other financial investment. It's their home. They have a lot of emotional investment, a lot of their self-worth tied up in that asset. And so on the one hand, you can say, well, you know, it was a good decision to try it. On the other hand, now these people have this emotional stake and this emotional investment, part of their self-worth tied up in their home, and they're losing not just the financial value of that investment, but also their a little bit of themselves.
Yeah, I suppose too. You might ask this question, particularly in at a time when the values of housing just kept going up and up and up. Whether people thought they in fact were taking a risk.
Well, I think that's important to get out of this policy discussion. That I sit here and talk in the studio about this cold cost benefit analysis. That's not the reality of the way most people purchase a home. They're relying on the banker. They're relying on their broker. They're relying on people with whom they really have an adversarial relationship with. The banker's not there to represent your best interest, but they're relying on their expertise. And then they say, here's a loan. We think you can afford to pay it back. Many people assume there's something in the system, whatever, you know, that means, the system that's going to make sure that they can pay that back. They wouldn't give me this money if they didn't think I could pay it back. And I think there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Lawless. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois, and among other things is particularly interested and is an expert in the fields of bankruptcy and corporate law. And he's a regular contributor to the blog Credit Slips, which is a discussion on credit and bankruptcy. And we're talking here about the current credit crisis. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here to bring into the conversation in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Pose for you to respond to. First of all, I think one of the better ways to respond to the problem of the foreclosures would be for the government to buy up these, these defaulting loans on a discount, so that the banks and the institutions that basically, sort of ran what I think was pretty, shoddy, if not, a scam, but certainly I think, they were sort of playing fast and loose to make a quick buck. Buy that up and then, negotiate with the individual homeowners so that they could stay in their homes and, work out some kind of repayment. I think that's a better way than just bailing out the banks and the financial institutions so that they end up, basically getting off scot-free and, the rest of the people, suffering. And then the other aspect of this, I'm wondering if you might see this as the tip of the iceberg, and that the whole, economic structure is, has so many structural problems in it that we might be on the verge of, while it's might be very different because we have different institutions to deal with things these days, but if we might have the kind of economic collapse that happened back at the 1929-1931 era?
Yeah, both of those are really good questions. Let's first deal with the idea of the government buying up some of this paper that's out there and buying it up at a discount. That's going to be very expensive. I haven't seen any estimates exactly on what the cost would be, partly because that depends upon what we're talking about, what we end up having the government buy, what's the cutoff or what the government buys. That's going to be a very expensive solution, although it may be the least expensive solution of our alternatives. The question on the tip of the iceberg, that is something that has me quite concerned. We've seen with the home mortgage market have some problems, and the basic market structure of the home mortgage market is very similar to what is also going on in the credit card industry, and credit card default rates are starting to inch up, and there's some concern that maybe we're going to see the kind of crisis we've had on the home mortgage side with the credit cards. There's a great I'll put a little plug in for our blog, the Credit Slips. We've got a visiting economist, Christian Weller, who has a great post up just yesterday on exactly this possible problem, the possibility that the consumer credit defaults could lead to some more structural problems with the economy.
Well, yeah, sometimes there are no good solutions. There's only, less worse choices to be made. But I just think it'd be very unjust if, this thing is dealt with in a way that takes a greater concern for the banks and lending institutions and, sort of leaves everybody else to sort of scuffle for themselves. I also think that, there's a lot more to be said about the whole decision about, how to reach the Constitution, Supreme Court ruling that you talked about earlier. I know that there's a great deal to be dealt with there, where basically that's when, the credit card companies, the banks, all sort of relocated legally to states that would give them the highest rates. And then, the Congress now, a few years ago went and basically made it a lot harder for people to declare bankruptcy. You know, it's all right if a big corporation declares bankruptcy, but, you know, heaven forbid that, you know, individuals out there in the middle class or the, you know, the missing class should go ahead and do that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what the caller said. You know, on the question of, well, let's not bail out the banks at the expense of the middle class. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. At the same time, I guess as I'm out there talking with people, there's a lot of disagreement about who's to blame for this. I personally think there's a lot of blame to go around on all sides. But the question of, well, do we bail out the borrowers or do we bail out the banks, I think is the wrong question. I think the question is going forward, as the caller suggested, I think we got a lot of bad solutions on the table, bad in the sense that we're going to have a lot of pain here in the short to intermediate term. And the question is to pick the least bad solution. It's going to be costly. There's going to be a lot of economic pain. And that's what we got to focus on going forward, is what's our best solution rather than, you know, what's happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. It seems that, you know, the way that this becomes a sort of snowballing problem is that and affects more than just the initial lenders and the borrowers, is that in most cases, lenders don't hold the mortgages. They sell them into the secondary market. Somebody else comes along and buys that mortgage and assumes the risk. And apparently what happened here was that in a lot of cases, these large numbers of these mortgages were all bundled up and sold to large financial institutions that then turned around and used that to generate income for them by selling bonds to investors. And their idea was, well, when the borrowers, the homeowners, when they pay their mortgage payments, we're going to get that money and then we're going to use that to pay off the holders of the bonds. Well, the whole thing came apart when people at the bottom defaulted and there were foreclosures and suddenly payments are not forthcoming. And now a lot of the risk has been shifted to these big institutions and now they're taking these big hits. And I don't know that there's much that, if anything, can be done for them.
Well, what you're talking about is a process known as securitization, which is basically the idea of taking any income stream and turning it into a security, hence the term securitization, that mm-hmm. can be sold on the securities markets. In this instance, the income stream was the income from those debts, the mortgage payments. That's the same thing that's happened to the credit card debts as well. All of this ultimately relies on the quality, as you rightly point out, of the underlying debt. And what the intermediary here that I think we have to be concerned about in all this is the credit rating agencies, who were saying these mortgage securities were less risky than they truly were. We've seen that was not true for the mortgage crisis, for the mortgage debt. And now mm-hmm. I'm concerned that the same thing, we may find the same thing is going to be true for these credit card securities that have been sold. And Lord knows what else is out there.
Yeah. Well, that then goes back to just a general question about the availability of credit, perhaps. And that is that what has happened here now over the past, I don't know how many years, is that consumers have been dealing with their shrinking buying power not by limiting their consumption, but by financing that with debt, going into debt. And so we have people who have a big credit card debt. And so we have here a situation where some people would argue that the problem is that credit is just too easy to get, and that in the case of the home mortgages, a lot of different kinds of lenders were coming out offering to lend people money, maybe more money than they should have and maybe on terms that they shouldn't. And then we have here also the issue of credit. It's very easy, unless, of course, you've managed to run up a lot of debt and got a bad credit history. It's pretty easy to get a credit card. Do you think that we do have a problem with credit in that, and the problem being that it's too easy to get?
Well, there's a micro and a macro answer to that, right? The micro answer is, well, of course, obviously, right, that credit is very easy to get, and we see a lot of people get into themselves into trouble at an individual level. The macro answer is, we as a society have gotten to the point where that's just not a realistic solution to turn off the tap. The economic growth of the 1990s and part of the early part of this decade was built upon the growth of consumer credit. if we, and you saw President Bush, part of President Bush's economic stimulus, his plan is for consumers to spend their way out of our economic troubles. For us to turn off the spigot of consumer credit would really mean a drastic restructuring of the economy. Indeed, a lot of the moves you see happening in Washington are moves to try to keep that spigot going. So the answer, I think, there's two different answers. Whether you're looking at the individual, where, yes, there's a lot of credit, people are getting themselves into trouble, or whether you're looking at the economy as a whole, where cutting off consumer credit would have drastic consequences.
All right, let's talk with someone in Watsika. They're on cell phone on our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting show. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple of quick points here. This has been fairly well covered in the news, various news shows, but what I wanted to share, and maybe have your guest comment, there was a show not too long ago about this, and basically I think it zeroed in either on Las Vegas or San Diego, whatever. I'm in my 50s. I grew up in middle class, and owning a home was a goal that everybody wanted to get to and kind of hold that near and dear to your heart. And these people that gotten this credit have gotten so far in over their heads that they've just this whole sale just abandoning neighborhoods. I mean, they've gone into some of these homes and the furniture's still in the house, and these people just literally walked away from everything. And it's very troubling to see that. And it's really a horse of a whole nother color here. It's rather more than troubling. But then my question is, I was wondering, given the rather obscure Supreme Court decision in the 70s, do you think that this whole crisis could be the stepson to the SNL debacle that we experienced some 20-some-odd years ago? I was wondering if that was at all related. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, now we've had two people reference that obscure Supreme Court decision, so maybe we should make it not so obscure. It's the Marquette National Bank decision. But on the question of the SNL crisis, I don't see this as a stepson. It's related in that some of the same economic dynamics are at work in terms of the decision making of the people extending the credit in the SNL crisis. We had people making decisions who weren't fully bearing the cost of those decisions. They overextended themselves, and we're seeing the same thing here, I think, with the banks. The people who made these decisions at these banks are now pretty much moved on and are not there to reap the consequences of what they've sown. The caller raised another very important point about what we would call externalities of the foreclosure crisis, externalities being a cost that you don't bear yourself. Foreclosure, of course, hits the person affected, hits the bank affected, but it's also we're seeing neighborhoods affected. We're seeing other people bear the cost, people who've been responsible and that they've had their they're being able to make their mortgage payments. They're not losing their homes, but their neighbors have, and we're seeing higher crime statistics in neighborhoods hit by foreclosures. We're seeing declining property values in neighborhoods hit by foreclosures. I saw a statistic the other day that as many as 1 in 20 homes may be in foreclosure in the Detroit area. Close your eyes for a second and think about a city block with 20 homes on it. And imagine at least one of those homes being under foreclosure. Mm-hmm. And you can get a sense of what that'll do to neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, going back to the regulatory issue then, I guess some people would say, well, what sort of are there any regulations, or what sort of regulations exist? What sort of are there rules that tell lenders who they can lend to, how much they can lend, what kind of information they have to have on that person to determine whether, in fact, that person is a good credit risk? Does government have anything about that, or is the individual lenders they essentially make up their own rules, and government says to them, well, you're on your own, and if you get into trouble, you're really on your own?
Well, it's the latter, right? It's a market system. The model for government regulation has been one of disclosure, that the role of the government is to ensure that the lenders disclose the terms of the borrowing, and we've seen that that doesn't work very well. Lenders have very complicated financial products, and their disclosures tend to confuse rather than help the borrowers. So the government role since the Marquette National Bank decision has been not to regulate interest rates, not to regulate the terms of lending, but to regulate the amount of disclosure. And I think that's been a pretty much of a failed policy. I think another thing that's important to mention here is that after the Bush administration took office, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and unless you looked at your dollar bills real closely, you probably don't even know what that is. The Comptroller of the Currency regulates national banks. And part of the mission of the Comptroller of the Currency is to regulate the safety and soundness of the national banking system. And they took the position that state consumer protection laws threatened the safety and soundness of national banks and prevented states from enforcing their consumer protection laws against these banks that were acting wrongfully. And the OCC said, we'll step in and we'll regulate this, but they have not. They've done a very poor job. This was a move the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately backed them up on. It was the first time that an agency on its own had decided the scope of its ability to preempt state laws that it found conflicted with its regulatory mission. But again, a move the Supreme Court ultimately upheld. There was a nice editorial, I thought, from Governor Spitzer of New York in the Washington Post. Now, I'm not going to remember the exact day, but it was last week, documenting how when he was attorney general, several of his enforcement initiatives against banks were blocked by this regulatory move from the OCC.
Well, given where we are now and given that I'm not sure that there really is all that much enthusiasm for regulation in Washington, I'm not exactly sure it matters what party you come from. Are people talking seriously, or do you think that there might be any kind of serious talk about increasing regulation and imposing some sort of rules on lenders that would require them to be tighter about who gets credits and credit and under what sort of terms?
I disagree with that there's not enthusiasm for regulation in D.C., at least on this topic. I think the field, the stage is set for consumer credit regulation of some type. Coming out of Congress, a previous caller mentioned the bankruptcy laws. They were changed in 2005 to make it harder for people to file bankruptcy. There's no enthusiasm for changing any of that, but I think there will be some enthusiasm for doing something. Now, whether that gets past the White House, which has announced its opposition to virtually all these bills pending in Congress, and there's numerous bills pending in Congress that would impose restrictions on the credit card companies. Whether it'll get past the White House is another question, but I do think there's some taste for more regulation coming out of Congress.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest is Robert Lawless. He is professor of law here at the University of Illinois, an expert in bankruptcy and corporate law. He's one of six regular contributors to the blog Credit Slips, which is a discussion on credit and bankruptcy. He's also a member of the Consumer Bankruptcy Project. It's a long-term research project looking at people who file bankruptcy. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller here in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I had found a Nicholas Bagley article on Slate about the OCC. Apparently it was three states or four states, some of the major holders of these that were trying to regulate subprime lending and were stopped by this OCC, which he points out that they get all their money from the banks basically get to pay for the operation of this Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Is that what OCC is? So you've sort of answered that. It just seems to me that the motive of why the federal government would stop this the states from trying to jump in before this thing blew up is, I think he's pointing at the fact that the banks were happy with the way they could sell these structural investment vehicles or whatever. So if you've gotten to that, I wanted to ask what you think about the bonding insurers and the Omniline, or as they call them in England, or the Monoline, as they call them here. The fact that the chill has gone to that has led to this thing last week where who's the billionaire from Omaha who was going to buy the safe part of it.
Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett, right. Offered to buy the safe part of the thing. I wonder, you know, what's going on there in the sense that, you know, it seems to have actually chilled spending at the municipal level. I think I heard a bit of news about some project in Chicago that was stopped because they couldn't sell another bond because of the chill and the bonding. Whether Buffett obviously saw it as a good deal, but separating the two would at least maybe let the cities do things, I suppose, since it would isolate the disastrous part of the portfolio from. Do you get my drift, and can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. Let me. So there are two points there. First, about the OCC and where they get their money from. They are funded by bank by fees the banks pay as part of the regulatory process. Despite my very strong criticisms of the OCC, I don't think there's been anything sinister there. I think the people running the OCC were good and well-intentioned. They're people who believe in market forces and letting the market run wherever it will. Although I think they were well-intentioned, I think the results of their policies have spoken for themselves. They've been a disaster. And then on the second question about the insurers, there are companies that help the securitization markets work that try to insure the riskiest of these of the underlying debt. As was pointed out earlier, as these securities are sold, really their value depends upon the quality of the underlying debt. And there are companies that would step in and say, well, if they won't pay, if the debtor doesn't pay, we'll pay. And these are the mortgage insurance companies that people would be familiar with when they have to go get a loan and their lender has them get mortgage insurance. Those companies are in trouble because those companies were insuring loans based upon representations from the lenders about the quality of the debt. Those companies say that those representations were inaccurate. The lenders are pointing fingers at the credit rating agencies, and there's just a lot of finger-pointing going on. We're, I think, in the early stages of the problems with those mortgage insurers and the credit insurers generally, because they operate in other markets as well, and that's that spillover effect, because we see them as consumers in the mortgage insurance markets, but they perform similar functions in other credit markets, such as the municipal lending market. In, as I say, I think we're in the early days of seeing the spillover effects of that, and there's been some recent news reports, the caller mentioned, of tightening credit for municipal borrowers as well.
Well, but the point being, what is the utility of separating it so that, as I mentioned, then the municipalities would be isolated from it? And the other thing is that I don't think that I was suggesting there was a conspiracy. I just think that the OCC sees its interests tied up with the banks, and they do have this rather extreme, and well, I guess I would call that sinister, extreme deregulation. Romney and his leaving said that he wanted to take a weed whacker to regulations, and that was going to free capitalism. And how you can say that when we have what we have in the way of environmental problems, and now even inside of capitalism itself, this lack of regulation that allowed this free-for-all to go ahead. Anyway, I'm editorializing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The word conspiratorial was mine, but also used by others. The OCC has attracted a good deal of criticism from people who work in this area. The question about, I'm not quite sure about separating it out for municipalities. What the caller was trying to suggest about that, but the idea has always been that the markets can divide up the risk of lending and. By specializing in risk, it's like any other economic transaction. As parties specialize, they become better at it. So as the insurers would specialize at these riskiest borrowers, they would be better at identifying them and at dealing with the risk and at pricing that risk. And that's why it gets sliced so narrowly. And, I'm not an economist, but as someone who looks at this from a regulatory perspective, there probably is some efficiencies there. That is, the market for credit gets sliced up and it becomes more and more specialized, then that's going to be better overall for the economy. But that's why it gets sliced so finely, why you see companies specializing in what seems to the average person a very arcane business.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else in Gilman. This is line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask your guest a couple questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I just tuned in, and maybe they've already been asked, but there were all these securities, subprime securities, packaged as A's. And is the bank the first one who packages those, or the mortgage insurance?
Well, the banks are typically the ones doing the packaging.
Okay. So if they're there misrepresenting them, this seems like something that nobody wants to talk about, aluminum chips being dropped out of the plane to destroy radar in the Second World War. Somebody's going to get sued, and these banks are going to get sued.
Yeah, the only thing I disagree there is that they're not going to get sued. They have been sued. There are already lawsuits being started with that. Yeah, there's no question there's going to be lots of lawsuits over this. Dealing with misrepresentations, as you pointed out.
Right, and a lot of these lawsuits are going to come from foreign countries. Is that not correct?
You mean because the investors of these securities ultimately are
right.
Foreign investors?
Right.
Well, there's no question about that, that the foreign investors, a lot of these securities are held by foreign investors. Whether they'll be inclined to use U.S. courts to seek redress for their losses is another question, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Okay, that's really all of my questions. The thing is, if some foreign banks have lost billions and billions of dollars, which they have, it seems to me their attorneys are already working on suing. And where does the American go to run for shelter?
Well, it's not clear to me necessarily that the foreign investors are going to use the U.S. courts. We may see. A lot of this debt is held by sovereign wealth funds, which is not exactly a bank, and it's not exactly another country. But we may see diplomatic maneuvers on these debt questions rather than resorting to the U.S. courts. But at the same time, obviously, there's going to be some lawsuits out of this.
Okay. Most of this is over my head, so I guess I'll just tune back into the radio and listen to the rest of your commentary.
Well, thanks.
Thank you for putting my question.
Well, I appreciate the question. I guess, though, I find myself going back to the comment that you made about the fact that there's a fair amount of blame to go around here, and I'm sure that a lot of people are going to be looking for somebody to sue. And, some people will say, well, the liability here is with the initial lender, and then but the initial lender would say, well, now wait a minute, we did our due diligence. You go and talk to the credit reporting agencies because they told us this person was okay to make the loan to, and who knows where that's going to get laid off, and then whoever packaged these things together, somebody is going to say, well, you sold us a bunch of bad debt or risky debt, and they're going to say, but we took that on in good faith because the other guys back down the line said that this was okay. You know, how do you sort all that out with different parties saying, well, I did my thing, the problem lies somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, how do you sort that out with lots of lawyers billing up lots and lots of hours, right? And that goes back to the caller's pre. That was a very good question about the lawsuits. Sorting this all out is going to be very, very, very expensive in the court system, and that's why when he asked about the foreign investors, I hesitate to say they're going to run right away into U.S. courts to solve these their problems stemming from this. They may use other avenues available to them.
Mm-hmm. Is there somebody who's more guilty than somebody else, or is it truly a matter of guilt being shared, you think?
Well, I think it depends upon where you sit. I think that the lenders played a major role in this. They were the ones with the information, the ones extending the credit initially. They were the ones that knew their borrowers, that knew who they were lending money to. The borrowers, a lot of people want to blame the borrowers and say, well, a lot of people say, I saved money, I'm... why should we help these people who borrowed recklessly? But I think that forgets that, again, that people, when they walk into a lending institution, are relying on that lending institution for their expertise. And the idea that people were out there borrowing money with great sophistication, knowing the terms exactly, knowing all this fine print. Anybody who's bought a home recently knows the the hundreds of pages of documents that you see when you buy a home. The idea that the average person was out there reading all that through and comprehending it, I think is just false.
Yeah. Do you think that it's a problem that in some people's minds they thought that at the end of the day the insurer last resort is the federal government, and that if there's a problem that ultimately the government is somehow, either because it maybe just simply because it has to, is going to come along and clean up the problem if there's a problem?
For the borrowers, no. I don't think that's at all the case. For I think your average consumer is just simply optimistic. We're all optimistic. That's a condition of the human animal, right, that we all tend to overestimate our future gains. We all tend to underestimate the possibility of bad things happening to us. And I think that the main dynamic that goes on is when people are sitting in the lender's office and looking at the terms of the loan, they say, well, I'll be able to do this, because we all overestimate our ability to do things like that.
All right. Champagne is next. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, Professor Lawless. From a loan economics perspective, would you say this subprime crisis that we're in is a classic case of market failure?
Well, it depends. I guess it depends on what you mean by market failure. You mean?
Basically the invisible hand of the market working things out that Milton Friedman and his proponents argue. It looks like here, without proper government intervention, the invisible hand of the market was not perfect.
Well, I mean, I guess that's why I ask about market failure, because there's a lot of reasons that markets can fail. And I think the only reasonable claim to markets working is that markets process the information that's given to them. There's this idea that markets are efficient, and what that means is that markets are perfect, that they get everything right. And that's not really what market efficiency is. Markets make mistakes. So, you know, is this a question of market failure? Well, and the markets were processing the information that they had. I wouldn't say necessarily it was a question of market failure, but the information that the markets needed more information than what they were getting.
My follow-up question is, normally when we have market failure, however you defined it, that the invisible hand of the market does not work efficiently, is that then we look to government intervention. And my question, I hear this problem discussed, but I've never heard a well-educated scholar like you, for example, proffer a position as to how government intervention might get us out of this mess. Do you have such a theory?
No. What I have, I think there are some things that will help. I don't think there's anything that's going to get us out of this mess. I think we're in for some short to intermediate term pain with people losing their houses. I think we're going to see lots of people lose their homes through foreclosure. I think there are some things that will help. One of the things I think would be the biggest help would be there's some bills pending in Congress to give bankruptcy judges the power to adjust the terms of a home mortgage. That's a power they currently lack. And people then say, well, would I have to file bankruptcy to get this relief? And the answer is probably not, because once that became the law, the lenders would then have to negotiate against the knowledge that if things didn't work out, the bankruptcy judge would have the power to adjust the mortgage. So this would make the lenders much more able to come to the table. But do I have a magic solution? No, I don't. I don't know that there is a magic solution here. Again, I think there's some things that will help alleviate some of the problems, but I don't have any, magic formula here to fix this.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks. You would think that the lenders would be willing to make some concessions, because it would be better to get something than to get nothing.
You would think that. And there have been some moves in the lending industry to try to work out terms. We've seen these in the news. There was the so-called teaser freezer plan in December. There was the Operation Lifeline, what was it, last week, that the major banks announced. But the early returns, at least on the teaser freezer plan, was that they haven't helped nearly as many people as the headlines would have suggested. I think the other thing we have to remember, though, is that the people who
originated the loan, the people who serviced the loan, and the people who now own the loans are all different people now. And it's very difficult to coordinate across those different groups of people. The system was never set up to handle this many defaults all at once.
One more caller here in Urbana, line number 3. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello, doctor. I just wondered, you mentioned a couple times that international holders of some of these problem loans would use other means to, instead of going to courts. And I wondered if you could describe who are these international people and or entities, and what are their options other than going to the courts? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. Well, we're talking about, of course, foreign banks. We're talking about individual investors overseas. But one of the largest investors, of course, would be something known as sovereign wealth funds that I think you'll be hearing a lot more about in the headlines. You're already probably starting to see a little bit about those. Especially with the price of oil going up, a lot of countries have huge amounts of wealth that they're looking to invest, and they're investing these through things known as sovereign wealth funds. It's the country itself, it's the sovereign itself that owns that wealth fund, and they like to say we're not the government, we're this wealth fund, but at the same time, this is clearly the government doing the investing. In terms of what other avenues, I was thinking of things such as, the G7 diplomatic efforts to try to get the United States maybe to do some of the bailouts that we've heard about here, to try to get the Federal Reserve to make moves to put money back in the credit system. I'm not necessarily suggesting that that's going to happen, but the caller, the previous question was asking about, what do you think the chances of these people going into court, these foreign investors? And, you know, I think the chances are that some of them will use that, but I just wanted to point out there are also other avenues available to them.
Just to go back to something you mentioned once before, when I asked you the question, I opined that maybe in Washington they wouldn't be really keen to regulate, and you said, well, in fact, maybe in this particular case, there are some people who are thinking, yes, mm-hmm. we do need to have some regulation. One of the things you did say, and this here touches on bankruptcy, I think people who look at credit and debt and the financial problems people get themselves into have been concerned about a change in bankruptcy law that's happened over the past few years that essentially makes it more difficult for individuals to file for bankruptcy. And it sounds as if I heard you right, you were saying that's something you don't think that there is any interest in.
Yeah, let me make clear, I was opposed to that law. I think that law is a disaster. That law was, as I've said, the poster child for campaign finance reform. It was bought and paid for by the consumer credit industry. As a descriptive matter, I can tell you I don't think there's much political will to go back and revisit that law. There may be changes at the margins. But that law was lobbied for 8 years. There were huge campaign contributions to get that law into place. And those forces that pushed that law through are still there to oppose any changes to that law. So I just don't think there's any will to go back to that. The members of Congress are kind of exhausted on the bankruptcy law. So I just don't think we're going to see them go back to that. I would like them to, but I just don't think politically that's a realistic possibility.
Yeah. Well, I certainly wasn't meaning to suggest that, to say anything about your personal position about that, whether what you were saying, but that you were just sort of stating what you thought were the facts on the ground in Washington is that's done, and they're not talking about going back and making any changes on that.
Yeah, that's right. No, don't worry. I'm always happy to be able to say that law was a disaster. It was a very poor law. But that's exactly right. It's just the facts on the ground in Washington is they're not going to revisit those 2005 changes to the bankruptcy law, at least in any major way.
Yeah. And what you think, though, that they actually might be willing to do?
I think there may be some changes to the consumer credit laws. There may be, I kind of hesitate to say this, more disclosure. I hesitate because I don't think that's a regulatory model that works very well. But there may be some. In fact, there are bills pending in Congress to make more disclosure, make the credit card companies have better disclosure, and also to regulate some of the more onerous terms, things known as universal default clauses, where you default, you miss a payment to your landlord and your credit card rate goes up. That's known as a universal default clause, to ban those. the lenders have already backed away from those to some extent, so I'm not sure how much good that would do. But those are the types of changes we may see coming out of Congress. Mm-hmm.
And are you worried, or is there a lot of worry that we may be seeing more problems in the future involved with here we're talking about home mortgage issues, but that we would be seeing more problems connected with consumer credit? You're essentially dealing with the issue that we have a lot of people in the United States who have a lot of credit card debt.
Well, I think, yes, there is concern about that. I have very grave concern. A statistic I like to throw out is we owe more money as a nation than we earn in personal income for a year. Our household debt is more than our personal income, and that was not true as recently as 2004. So going forward, yes, we have so much consumer credit out there, we're not going to be able to continue to continue to sustain that, and I think that's the reason you're seeing the predictions for a contraction.
Yeah. Well, at that, we'll have to leave it, I'm sure, on other shows. We'll get back to some of these issues, but for the moment, we'll close with our thanks to Robert Lawless. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for the broadcast today comes from Provena Medical Group, where doctors treat people, not illness. More information is available at 1-866-PROVENA. The physicians of Provena Medical Group encourage you to join them in supporting WILO. Before we go here, a reminder, tomorrow morning on the program in the first part of the show, we'll be talking about what's involved in preserving audiovisual media in the home and in the archives. And we'll have a couple of guests, Jimmy Jones, project coordinator for the Audiovisual Self-Assessment Program Conservation Unit at the U of I Library, and also Emma Saito Lincoln. She's a media preservation coordinator in the preservation department of the U of I Library. And what we'll try to do here is provide some basic information to folks who have their own audio, video stuff that they would like to preserve, and I'm really not quite sure how to do that for the long term. Then in the second part of the show, a program that I'm sure is sure to generate some controversy, no doubt, we'll be talking with Ali Alawi. He is a senior advisor to the Prime Minister of Iraq. He's also former Minister of Trade and Minister of Defense under the interim Iraqi Governing Council, and former Minister of Finance in the Iraqi Transitional Government. And he's authored a book that's titled The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. And he'll be joining us to talk tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned, because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Egg Magazine, and the host of the show is Celeste Gwynn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be a law professor from Washington University, Christopher Allen Bracey, and we will talk with him about his book, Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. That conversation happens following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. March wheat trading at 10.88, up 6. In Chicago, March wheat 10.28. up 1/2. July 956.5, up 19. March corn 519.75, up 5. May 532.25, up 5.25. July 544.25, up 6. December 544.25, up 6.25. March beans 1393, up 19.25. May 1411, up 19.75. July 1422.75, up 20.25. November 1352, up 34.5. March meal 360.60, up 180. March oil 60.07, up 150. At the Merck in Chicago, February live cattle 91.35, down a nickel. April 93.97.5, unchanged. March feeder cattle 104.30, down 32.5. April 107.60, down 45. February lean hogs 58.49, up 11.5.